Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, July 16th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, fire updates on the Orleans Complex and Marble Complex fires, Senate vote begins on funding that could shape the future of public broadcasting, and Avelo departs Humboldt County. So stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming up. Operations Section Chief on CA Team 9, Jeff Henson, gives an update on the Marble Complex fires from the Klamath National Forest Facebook news release on today's overview of activity on both fires, status, and plans for today and going forward.
Our jacket fire down here in the Sawyer's Bar area, we've had containment on that for well over a week. No smoke, no heat showing on that fire. Things are good. On the Summit fire, pretty much the same thing. Not a lot of heat or smoke coming off the Summit fire. Most of our heat is underneath Maneaton Lake to the north of Maneaton and down off the cliff band there. Basically, it's isolated sources of heat, like in brush fields that are surrounded by rock, hard to get to by foot. So we're really monitoring those by air and by the guys on the ground or keeping eyes on there. No real issues. We also have a little bit of heat on the Pacific Crest Trail in a switchbacky area that has some down logs that are still burning out and smoldering. Again, pretty steep, rough ground to get into, so we're monitoring those and expect those to burn down in the next couple days. Crews out there currently are still spiked out on the hill, so they're out there 24 hours a day, mainly kind of securing our lines, chasing any smokes that they still see, and then starting to repair some of the lines that aren't going to threaten any further spread on the fire. Things are looking really good out there. We are starting to, every day we're pulling crews off that line, dwindling it down to one crew by Friday, the 18th, and we'll be turning it back over to the Klamath National Forest to finish management of the fire. That crew will be in for a few more days, and then after that, the forest will be monitoring it by air. So we're looking really good, containment's there, and we should be wrapping this thing up and handing it back, so.
The Summit fire is currently 700 acres and 65% contained. No additional fire growth has occurred and the containment is steadily increasing. As activity declines, staffing is gradually reduced and work is progressing towards high-level containment by the week's end. An area closure order is currently in effect due to the Summit fire, and residents and visitors are asked to avoid these areas and remain vigilant of changing fire conditions. The Jacket fire is currently 46 acres and 96% contained. Crews have transitioned fully to aerial patrol, and regular flyovers continue to show no signs of flare-ups or heat. Today is expected to be one last day of hot, dry weather and shifting winds, and a chance of thunderstorms are expected later in the day. As winds shift southwest, smoke from the Marble Complex may be more noticeable in nearby communities. Although fire activity remains low, crews are staying alert for weather changes that could affect fire behavior and visibility. A combination of evacuation warnings and orders are in place for both the Summit and Jacket Fire. Visit the Office of Emergency Services Disaster Management website for Siskiyou County, California. To stay updated, you can visit watchduty.org or by typing in Humboldt Alert Sign Up in your internet browser. KMUD News will continue to update as we get new information. Planning Operations Section Chief Leif Matheson gives an update on the Orleans Complex from Klamath National Forest Facebook news release on today's overview of activity of both fires, status, and plans for today and going forward.
So starting here in Division Alpha, crews continue to work and reinforce and protect the structures of Nordheimer and Nordheimer Creek. Fire activity just east of Nordheimer Creek up along this ridgeline. The fire continues to finger up that ridgeline and then flank along the road. So crews are in there reinforcing work around the structures and then holding the Salmon River Road. As we move south and east towards Division Delta, this hand line was constructed and completed over the last couple days. They've begun to snag it, and then crews plan to put a hose lay in from drop point 52 all the way down to the Salmon River Road today. Working around towards DP 55 and DP 50, those crews have plumbed that. They're doing a little bit of prep work on that, and they will in preparation for future firing operations. Moving around into Branch 2, Division Hotel, crews are still making good progress along here. There is a little bit of fire that has come through some green stringers across Granite Creek that's working its way up towards Orleans Mountain. So they'll be using some aircraft on that today. They're pretty confident that as it gets into the Boise fire scar that it'll slow down and they'll be able to pick some of that fire up. Moving around in a Tango, similar at drop point 70 here where this fire has pushed up, they're going to work aircraft on that, continue to hold that in place. Tango is out scouting today and figuring out what the best options are for bringing contingency line around back into Division X-Ray. Division X-Ray here in Butler Structure Group has been looking real good for several days now. They continue to mop up and patrol, but we have no issues or control problems in Division X-Ray.
The Butler Fire is currently at 9,191 acres and 0% containment. The road between Butler Flat and Nordheimer Campground remains closed as rocks and burning debris continue to fall into the roadway. Nordheimer and Oak Bottom Campgrounds are still closed. Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office has expanded its evacuation orders July 15th to include FRK-1709, Forks of Salmon, SIS-1707-B, SIS-1708, SIS-1804, and SIS-1805. They join the following zones already under an evacuation order: SIS-1703, SIS-1704, Butler Creek, Lewis Creek, Bloomer Mine Residence, and Nordheimer Campground, SIS-1707-A, and SIS-1083-A. Zones SIS-1705, SIS-1710, SIS-1802, SIS-1808, and SIS-1906 are under an evacuation warning, where residents are advised to be prepared to evacuate if conditions become more threatening. The latest evacuation information can be found at protect.genesis.com. That's protect.genasys.com. The Red Fire is currently at 116 acres and 95% containment. There are no current evacuation orders for the Red Fire. Temperatures are expected to be slightly cooler today with highs in the upper 90s. Winds will mostly come out of the northwest with occasional gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Conditions are subject to change at any time. KMUD will continue to bring updates as they come. For more information, visit kmud.org and tap under the Fire Resources tab. Today, the Senate continues discussion on the final vote, whether or not to pass President Donald Trump's request to claw back $9.4 billion in public media and foreign aid spending. A final package must be approved by both chambers by July 18th. If not, the package expires and funding is restored. The House already approved Trump's request yesterday on a mostly party line 214 to 212 vote. This rescissions act would eliminate $1.1 billion in public media funding that has already been approved by law for the next 2 years. If enacted, this could be devastating for local stations' ability to serve their communities, and could even force some stations off the air. Communities across the country could lose access to life-saving emergency alerts, educational resources for children, families, and educators, workforce training and certification programs, local journalism, high school sports coverage, and community storytelling. The National Federation of Community Broadcasters, a group in line to lose funding from this vote, said in a public statement yesterday that approximately 200 community stations nationwide are represented by them. 120 rural stations rely on CPB for at least 25% of their budgets, and 33 stations rely on them for more than 50%. KMUD is one of those rural stations. If CPB was defunded, stations would face the urgent and difficult task of replacing the loss of federal funding that underpins civic infrastructure and public safety communications. End quote. Community and tribal radio are lifelines in emergencies. AM/FM radio is the most reliable medium when power, internet, and cell networks fail. Federal investment in public media is not a luxury. It is a lifeline. End quote. For more information, visit protectmypublicmedia.org under the Call Your Senators tab. KMUD is following the Senate vote and will provide updates when the final vote is in. You can also follow along on this vote by visiting pbs.org/newshour/. Amid backlash for their contract to fly deportation flights for ICE, Avelo announces that they'll be ending their service in California at the end of 2025, citing financial issues, not politics, as the reason, Lisa Music reports.
Avelo Airlines has announced it will cease all West Coast operations by the end of 2025. The decision comes amid scrutiny over the airline's contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to operate deportation flights. Second District Supervisor Michelle Bushnell confirmed the news earlier this week.
We got notice 2 days ago that Avelo will have their last flight, I believe it's December 2nd of 2025. And what it means for Humboldt County, despite any feelings about Abello and keeping politics out of it, is just less services for Humboldt County and less opportunities for affordable flights. I never like to see things leave Humboldt County, and especially in our time right now, you know, economics are huge. Our businesses aren't doing well. People utilize those cheaper flights for business, for medical reasons. Also, it allows people to travel into Humboldt County for a cheaper price so that they can spend money in our county. And so it just is a lost opportunity when, you know, we lose airlines coming in and out.
Bushnell said Avello's departure will leave Humboldt County and other rural communities with fewer options for affordable air travel, impacting not only local tourism and business, but also access to essential medical care. For some residents, the consequences are personal. Doug Colbert spoke with KMA News on the impacts to his family.
My wife, Jennifer, has stage 4 breast cancer. She was being treated in near Atlanta, Georgia, at the Cancer Treatment Centers of America. And through their foundation, which is a private foundation, they were able to cover our flights for almost 8 years for both of us. So we never had to pay for our plane flights. And we'd get the bill, like the invoice, and it'd be about $1,300 to $1,600 every time we'd fly over there. But Cancer Treatment Centers of America actually paid for those flights. And so that's what allowed us to go to Atlanta to get her the best care that she needed. And then about the same time that they sold the hospital, they were bought out by City of Hope. They stopped paying for flights for patients to come. So City of Hope had a hospital in Southern California, which was closer to us, so we didn't have to fly clear across the country. And since we were going to have to start paying for our own travel, Avello was our best option. The first flights that we were getting round trip tickets for $50 when they first started out. So you can't beat that. Both of us flying for $100.
With Avello offering budget fares, the family was able to afford ongoing cancer treatment out of the area. Now that financial lifeline is vanishing.
In this instance, she had a scan a month ago and they didn't like the results. So they're actually having her come back sooner. So she's has a 2 month trip. You know, we were just there 2 months ago, paid for that flight, actually a month ago. And now we're going next month and have to pay for another flight. And we're using Avello. If things are copacetic for this one, she'll probably have to go back again in November, which we're hoping to get one more flight in before the December cutoff, because it's going to be about a $600 difference. And the thing is, you know, I've had discussions with people who says, oh, well, you know, if you catch United at the right time, you can get really cheap flights, which we have coincidentally, but we have to schedule our flights around her appointments, not the other way around. So we set her appointments and we have to take the flights that work for those dates.
Despite speculation, Avello has not cited politics or the boycott as a factor in its exit. In fact, publicly available flight data shows the company's flights into and out of California's Humboldt County Airport remained at normal capacity in the months following the start of the boycott campaign. Avello has also emphasized that its departure is part of a broader realignment and cost-cutting strategy as it pivots to focus on more profitable East Coast markets. Still, the boycott, launched in response to Avello's deportation flight contract with the Department of Homeland Security, is ongoing. The airline continues to operate flights in other parts of the country, and its contract with DHS remains active. That's why campaign leaders say their work isn't over.
Ultimately, the aim is to stop these mass deportations, to provide everybody in this country with due process rights, to reverse this sort of mean-spirited, cynical, you know, terrifying policy. That ultimately is the goal for sure. But advocating a boycott of Avello is a way of pressuring a company that is profiting off of these and A, get that company to stop, and then B, show other companies that they shouldn't be engaging in this sort of unethical behavior just to make a buck.
Matthew Boulay of StopAvello.org argues that consumer pressure is a legitimate tool for accountability.
Every day as consumers, we make lots of decisions about where we're going to spend our money. And I think all of us want to spend our money in ways and on behalf of products and to companies, you know, that are acting in ethical ways in accordance with longstanding values that we hold dear, democratic values like due process and respect for individual rights. And so a boycott is simply a way of saying, I'm putting my money where my mouth is, and more importantly, I'm not putting my money where my values aren't. So I don't believe in what this company is doing is appropriate, and therefore I'm not giving them money to continue doing that. You know, I draw my inspiration, and I think many other activists draw their inspiration from the civil rights movement, from the work of Dr. King, from the Montgomery bus boycott. You know, in 1955, the public buses were segregated, and Dr. King, as a very young activist, he was in his 20s, asked the people of Montgomery, Alabama, to stop riding the public buses until they desegregated. And what they thought would take a few weeks or months ended up taking more than a year. And what that literally meant was folks were walking miles to work or miles to school instead of taking the bus. So they did this boycott, you know, at extreme sacrifice to themselves. They walk all year long. The summers are hot and humid. But it was a way of standing up for what you believe in. And that's a value that I think all of us hold dear, is to spend our money with companies, you know, that we are proud of, not appalled by.
But others in the community say the impact is being felt most by working families, not airline executives or federal agencies.
I understand that people, you know, they have their strong political beliefs, but what a lot of people don't really think about, and I've been the same way, is that when they want something like this, like the boycott of a Velo, they're not thinking of the people that it's actually affecting.
Supervisor Bushnell agreed that Humboldt County will be left with fewer affordable travel options, and residents who fly for medical care will be hit the hardest.
What it means for Humboldt County, obviously, we're not going to get as many travelers coming in when you have flights that are up to, you know, comparably when they were $350 up to $1,000. People just aren't going to choose to fly, you know, that route because it cuts into your vacation money, right? When you're looking for somewhere to vacation and spend your money, you're not looking to spend all your money on an airplane flight. And so it does affect the folks coming into Humboldt County. Additionally, you know, there are quite a few folks that fly down south for medical reasons. And I know, you know, when you're dealing with cancer or whatever your medical reason is, you already have a lot of expenses that aren't budgeted. And so having to fly down there every 2 to 3 months, you know, I read your interview with Doug Colbert, and I know them personally. I went to high school with Doug and Jennifer. They're my age, and I know that they, you know, Jennifer is in the fight for her life. She has stage 4 breast cancer, and she has to fly down there, and she's not alone. There are many folks that fly out of the area for medical care, and so it just means an increase in an expense for them, and it's not an option. They have to get down there, and so that just makes it so much more difficult when you're trying to save your life.
Boulay, however, maintains that deportation flights under the current administration are unprecedented in scope.
Yeah, I mean, no administration has ever engaged in mass deportations like the current administration. First of all, it is shrouded in rhetoric of hatefulness and anger. You know, it's a very ugly public conversation from the administration about the role of immigrants in this country. So there's a hatefulness that plagues and undermines all of this immigration discussion because of the administration's stance. But secondly, the process itself is being contorted or perverted in ways we've never seen. When we talk about due process means that every single one of us has a right to our day in court. If you're arrested for whatever it is, you have a right to go in front of a judge and argue your case. That is being completely ignored by this administration. So immigrants also have that right. And every previous administration, Democrat and Republican, has respected that right. And the Trump administration has simply ignored that right. That's what due process is. And I think people can think about it in their own lives. If you were issued a speeding ticket, you have a right to contest it. That's what due process is. To not have that right is to have a very fundamental American liberty and privilege be taken from you. So that's never happened before. And then while it's true that other airlines have flown deportation flights in the past under previous administrations, it's always been during periods where the due process rights were respected. So it's never the case, never been the case that a commercial airline has flown deportation flights the way Avello is doing it now, folks who never got their day in court, and frankly, who are being deported to countries where they have no connection, not the country of origin. And that's inhumane. You can't, in any sort of good conscience, send somebody to a country where they have no ties, don't speak the language, have no support system, and just kick them off at the airport. They're going to be very vulnerable. And that's not what America stands for. America is a country that has always been a beacon of hope around the country for immigrants coming from afar, hoping to make a better life, hoping to have a chance to create opportunity for themselves and their family and their children and their children's children. That's what America's always stood for. We've been very proud of that for generations. And this administration has turned all of that upside down, wrapped itself in this rhetoric of hatefulness and mean-spiritedness. And Avello is a part of that. So for Avello to say there's precedence, we're only doing what others have done, is nonsensical and insincere.
Avello's final flight out of Humble is scheduled for December 2nd, 2025. While the airline is leaving California, the national debate over deportations and the role of private companies in carrying them out shows no sign of grounding. Reporting for KMUN News, I'm Lisa Music.
In state news, judge orders pause for Trump executive order ending birthright citizenship, KPFA's Dahlia Lozier reports.
A federal judge on Thursday blocked the Trump administration from enforcing an executive order which would end birthright citizenship. The order directs federal agencies to refuse to recognize the citizenship of children born in the United States who do not have at least one parent who is an American citizen or green card holder. Dr. Caitlin Patler is an associate professor at the UC Berkeley Goldman School of Public Policy and the lead drafter of an amicus brief in a related case about birthright citizenship. She discussed the sheer volume of people this order could affect.
We calculated that 4.74 million U.S.-born children over the next two decades would be stripped of their citizenship or unable to access citizenship in the United States, which would cause irreparable harm for not just those children, but for the country.
This decision comes in the wake of a Supreme Court ruling issued on June 27th, which paved the way for the enforcement of the executive order, which Trump issued on his first day back in office. The High Court's ruling did not address the question of whether Trump's executive order is constitutional. Instead, the conservative majority declared that three federal judges who had previously issued nationwide injunctions lacked the authority to do so and sent the matter back down to the lower courts. Importantly, though the Trump administration hailed this ruling as a victory, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who wrote the majority opinion, made clear that plaintiffs could likely obtain essentially the same type of relief as provided in a nationwide injunction by instead bringing class action lawsuits. Hours after the Supreme Court's decision, the ACLU and others filed class action lawsuits on behalf of non-U.S. citizens whose children would be affected. Celia Wang is the ACLU legal director.
There are still many open pathways to block President Trump's illegal and unconstitutional birthright citizenship order and ensure that all babies born in the U.S. are equal citizens, as the rule has been in our country since the end of the Civil War.
The New Hampshire judge, Joseph LaPlante, was the first judge to certify one of these challenges as a class action lawsuit. He said that the injunction was warranted, saying that, quote, the denial of citizenship to the plaintiff's members' children would render the children either undocumented non-citizens or stateless entirely, unquote. The dean of UC Berkeley's law school, Erwin Chemerinsky, spoke about the importance of Judge LaPlante's ruling.
I think there's two important implications to what the judge did. First, he again has stopped President Trump's unconstitutional effort to end birthright citizenship. And second, he provides a model for judges across the country in showing how nationwide class actions can be certified to stop unconstitutional presidential policies.
Lawyers with the ACLU are now urging Judge LaPlante to go further by certifying a nationwide class of babies and their parents who would be affected by Trump's order. They say without a court order, thousands of families nationally would be unprotected. Judge LaPlante said his decision applies nationwide to anyone who would have been subject to Trump's executive order. Dr. Patler of UC Berkeley discussed the impact of this ruling, not just on the children, but on their parents as well.
As someone who has two children, like what happens to your babies happens to you. And so I understand why the ACLU would have sought certification that included those parents. Because in a lot of ways this is punishing. This executive order is meant to punish them and deter them. But it is about the rights and privileges of the children themselves.
LaPlante said he would stay his ruling for 7 days to allow the Trump administration time to appeal and would issue a written decision by the end of the day. Under the Supreme Court's ruling, Trump's executive order had been set to take effect on July 27th. This new ruling puts the birthright citizenship issue on a fast track to return to the Supreme Court. For KPFA News, I'm Dahlia Lozier.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's been more than a year since the Government Accountability Board released a study and issued recommendations addressing food insecurity among tribes. However, neither Congress nor the USDA have acted on them. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
In its findings released in July 2024, the GAO found that Native households were more than twice as likely to deal with food shortages or problems securing nutritious meals. Catherine Laren is the GAO's director. She mentions a few common factors.
Just the more rural and remote locations of tribal communities. They are harder to reach. There is less access to a variety of nutritious foods, and the cost of the foods is higher than often you find in more urban areas.
Among the recommendations the GAO has made is letting tribes administer more food and nutrition service programs and addressing dual participation in SNAP and food distribution programs. Marlon Skenendor is an Oneida Nation counselor who worked with the GAO during its research and surveying of tribes. He says traditional foods are important, but so is affordability and access.
Wild rice is super expensive now, and berries are getting up there. So it's all about direct access. I always think of an idea of how we can subsidize some of our traditional indigenous foods. And we kind of do that now. We have a tribal elder food box that happens twice a month that is mostly indigenous sourced.
The GAO's 6 recommendations are intended to improve knowledge of food security among tribal communities and improve services. But while Congress and the USDA have agreed with the recommendations, nothing has been done yet. Mary Green Trottier is a Spirit Lake tribal member who also serves as the director of the National Associate of Food Delivery Programs on Indian Reservations. She says studies and recommendations are fine, but now it's time to collaborate towards remedies.
We know the problems. We know we can address the solutions. We are boots on the ground, and just listening to our voices and utilizing that knowledge.
The USDA says it's actively working to address the GAO's recommendations, but did not address any specifics on a timeline. And two congressional committees that work in Indian Affairs did not return requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida is taking action in its opposition of the so-called Alligator Alcatraz, an immigrant detention facility in the Everglades. In a press release Tuesday, the tribe said it's filing suit as an intervening plaintiff in a case being brought by Friends of the Everglades, Center for Biological Diversity and Earth Justice. The suit's against the state and the federal government. The tribe's raising concerns over environmental impacts and safety. The tribe says the facility is on traditional homelands and near traditional Miccosukee and Seminole villages. In a statement, Chairman Talbert Cypress said, the Miccosukee tribe is committed to ensuring that ancestral lands in Big Cypress will not become a permanent detention facility. He says they've reached out to the state and federal government expressing concerns but have not heard of a closing date. So they're taking legal action. The Omaha Tribal Council has adopted a cannabis regulatory code to establish the first medical and adult-use cannabis system in Nebraska. According to a press release Tuesday, the tribe's asserting its sovereignty with the action and building a sustainable economy. The move comes after voters approved medical cannabis last year. The tribe says a phased rollout will begin this year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Lisa Music, Dahlia Lozier, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us at kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.